A homeless encampment has popped up in a popular park in Palm Beach County. What will officials do next? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Dozens of tents are clustered in John Prince Memorial Park in Lake Worth. Yesterday, county officials tried to assess the situation. But what does that mean? And will the homeless have to leave? Also, it was a little more than 50 years ago when a group of black students held a sit-in at Swarthmore College. Like those led by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., they were fighting for civil rights. We'll talk with one of the women who took part in the sit-in. They turned their story into a book. And Florida is the most dangerous place for cyclists in the country. Can we fix it?
We should have entire groups of people that commute on it, and it can be done.
Today, a conversation with cyclists about making the roads safer for everyone. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Palm Beach County officials visited John Prince Memorial Park in Lake Worth yesterday to speak with those living in a homeless encampment. Dozens of homeless people have set up tents in the park, raising concerns for local officials and residents. Members of the ACLU were also on site to interview the homeless and remind folks of their rights. There were initial concerns that the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office had planned to clear out the encampment. Now, the issue was discussed at length in Tuesday evening's County Commission meeting. Palm Beach County Mayor Dave Kerner joins me now. Mayor Kerner, thank you so much for the time.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me on your wonderful show.
So you went with officials to the encampment to talk with folks living there, again, at John Prince Memorial Park. Tell me a little bit about what happened and what you saw and who you spoke to.
Well, I can tell you that it wasn't my first time visiting the encampment, if you will. But it was certainly the tensions were raised a little bit yesterday when I arrived. We had about 30 staff members from the county are part of our Department of Human Services. We also had some law enforcement out there and some volunteers from the ACLU, as you've mentioned. And we had a great, you know, by and large, it was a great day. It was a great interaction with the folks that were living there. A lot of compassion, a lot of understanding. It was a day of assistance and compassion. And really, we were there to interact with the homeless population and see how we could help as we move into this 90-day plan that the Sheriff's Office and the county are working on.
Can you tell me how many tents, how many people are out there?
I can tell you with the relative specificity is about 70 tents, and I would say in excess of 100 people. You had some folks that were living together in a tent. I didn't see any children or any young members of the encampment, but certainly there were members of the public that spoke about having their children stay there with them. So 70 tents, probably 120, 130 people.
When did you first hear about this encampment and when people started to gather there?
I actually didn't hear about it initially. I drive past John Prince Park every day on my way to the county commission. I've lived, born and raised right there about a mile from the park. And so I saw as time progressed, if you will, the rise of a community, and that's essentially what it was. And it started out small, but as time went on, I would say over the course of a year, it began to grow into what I would say a pretty well-organized community.
And as you saw that happening, I mean, what's going through your mind?
Well, you know, a lot of concern and I would say compassion for the folks that were living in the park. I don't think anybody grows up wanting to live in a tent in a park, and I think it spoke to a larger issue about housing in Palm Beach County intertwined in the confluence of some very prominent mental health issues that were evident when you spoke with some of the folks, and also some substance abuse issues. And as I went in there from time to time, we had some very candid conversations about why these folks were in the position that they were in.
Tell people a little bit about it, because if they don't know what John Prince Park looks like, it's a very big park.
It is. It's a very big park just off the interstate. So if you were to divide Palm Beach County horizontally or laterally in half, it's probably right just south of the midpoint of Palm Beach County. You can call it an urban suburban area. It's very large with a large lake. It's attached to a small general aviation airport. And Really, it's where I grew up. So when I was very young, I could go to John Prince Park by myself. It was one of the few places. And it's really sort of an oasis of open land and natural lands intertwined with some bodies of water. And it's really a beautiful resource.
Now, you talked about as you watch this encampment grow, but as mayor, tell me, what have you heard from residents? What have you heard from businesses about, their concerns?
Well, I can tell you that John Prince Park is principally surrounded, at least on the east side and sort of where the encampment was, by residential homes that are on a very nice lake. And certainly I heard, and I do represent that district, and I heard on an ongoing basis, some insensitive comments about, I don't want to see this every day, these people shouldn't be here, a lot of generalizations and lack of empathy or sympathy. But what I will tell you is, as this issue grew, and I'm on NPR now, speaking to a much broader audience, there was a lot of compassion and a lot of interest in how can we help and what can the government do to help these folks.
All right, I'm speaking with Palm Beach County Mayor Dave Koerner. I'm getting a little bit of a glitch with the phone. Hopefully we can get that fixed. We're talking about Tent City. This is a homeless encampment in Palm Beach County. County officials launched a plan to address the homeless encampment at John Prince Memorial Park west of Lake Worth Beach. And again, the ACLU was there with them yesterday as they were making an assessment of the situation. Mayor, are there enough homeless shelters, enough beds, enough services in the county for these folks?
Well, I'll break that into a two-part question, and I hope you and your listeners can hear me better now. I apologize for any interference from I'm on a cell phone. Are there enough beds? No. That's a categorical objective standard. There are not. We are working on that. We are building new shelters from ad valorem taxes that have been approved by the voters of Palm Beach County. Now, are there enough resources, which is a separate question? I think we have a robust level of resource available to homeless population, available to veterans, available to any vulnerable population in Palm Beach County. And so certainly we need more beds, but I am inspired and confident that the resources that we have are helpful to the population.
The other thing, too, is this, is you talked about this 90-day plan. I want you to tell me a little bit about that. But first, your concern as a mayor, is that any time a city or a community has to deal with a group of homeless people, if you don't do it humanely, if you don't do it right, it becomes a PR nightmare nationally. You become headlines. How do you handle this situation without basically everyone in the country looking down upon you on your actions?
Well, I got to tell you, after being in elected office for almost 8 years, I was a police officer before and a prosecutor. I've had my fair share of scrutiny and criticism. It's not something that affects me personally anymore. But what I can tell you is that there's no excuse and there's no reason not to treat every human being with compassion. So, my perspective has always been, how can we help this population? Ultimately, we will have to move the population to a different area. It's not appropriate to have an encampment in John Prince Park. And we can do a better job of providing services, protection, and safety if we move this population. But I've never really worried about any scrutiny or public backlash, because the bottom line is, we're going to comply with the law. We're going to do it in a compassionate manner. And we're going to do it in a way that's effective to help these folks get back on their feet.
And you talked about this 90-day plan. What is that?
Essentially, the 90-day plan, and it's not written in stone, and it involves several agencies, and principally the Sheriff's Office of Palm Beach County for some of the enforcement issues. And I can tell you, one of the main complaints and concerns that I heard from the homeless population were bad actors within that community that would commit crimes, steal items, commit domestic violence, things of that nature. And there was a general sense of not feeling safe and secure. And whether you're homeless or not, the government needs to provide that level of safety and protection. And so that's part of the 90-day plan, is not just assessing how we can provide wraparound services, but where can we place these folks, whether it's in shelters, whether it's in rapid rehousing, or even if it's in an encampment similar to the one that's in John Prince Park, if that's their preference, we will do that. But it has to be done in a way where the government's held accountable and the services are provided as we would any other member of Palm Beach County.
a story that we'll keep our eyes on, and we will definitely keep in touch with you, Palm Beach County Mayor Dave Koerner. Mayor, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you very much for covering this very important issue.
Thank you. Well, still to come, a civil rights protest more than 50 years ago changed sit-ins on college campuses around the country. We'll hear one of those stories coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. More than 50 years ago, Marilyn Hollyfield was a senior at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. Her and a group of fellow black students created an organization focused on improving black curriculum at the college, as well as treatment of black students by the administration. In January of 1969, they led an 8-day sit-in at the college admissions building. Their sit-in became a national story, and it was a critical part of the civil rights battle on campuses throughout the country. The story, written from the 8 students' perspective, is in the new book, Seven Sisters and a Brother. Hollyfield is a co-author for the book, and she lives in Miami. She's a partner at the law firm Holland & Knight. She joins me now to tell us about this story. Ms. Hollyfield, thank you so much. It's such a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Let me start with your story. You grew up in Tallahassee. This is at the time, is segregated South. When did your interest to go north, to go to college, when did that start to circulate in your mind?
I grew up in Jim Crow, Tallahassee, in the backyard of Florida A&M University. My parents are graduates of historically black colleges and universities, but my mother was from Boston. And for me, growing up, going to Boston during the summers for vacation instilled a notion that we could get a better education up north and potentially an education that was free of racial hostilities and free of the heaviness of Jim Crow.
Something interesting, too, is you had these experiences. I read about your experiences in Boston, so different from Tallahassee, but at the same time, it's not to say there were racial issues of racism in Boston, too. But you didn't see that often, did you?
I didn't see it. I learned later on that our visits to museums and parks and stores were carefully orchestrated to shield us from the racism in Boston. As many during that era, I probably felt like black people who moved from the South to the North during the Great Migration in hope of a better life. And my parents did a wonderful job of shielding the three of us from the racial hostilities in Boston by making sure that wherever we went, we did not see or feel it.
Tell us a little bit about Swarthmore. Give us a little bit of background, because it has a very unique history.
Swarthmore College was founded in 1864, 1 year before the Civil War ended, and 1 year after the Emancipation Proclamation by Abraham Lincoln. It was founded by Quakers. Its initial board of directors was 50% women and 50% men, which at that time was different and unusual, and suggested a degree of progressive politics or considerations in education. One of the appealing things about Swarthmore was its Quaker-influenced origins and its Quaker-influenced settings and reputation, in addition to being a highly acclaimed educational institution.
Now, you talked about being a little bit more progressive, but when you arrived, what was it like for you? What did you start experiencing?
Swarthmore was founded in 1864, as I said. In 1968, a little more than 100 years later, there were less than 100 black students who had been enrolled in Swarthmore. We later learned that Swarthmore intentionally excluded blacks completely, intentionally, up until 1943. And from 1943 up until 1964-65, Swarthmore limited intentionally the admission of blacks to one or two per year. My class was the largest class of black students that had ever been admitted to Swarthmore, a class of about 20. Long story short, in Swarthmore's 100 years of history, fewer than 100 students had ever attended Swarthmore College when I arrived.
What was different about the kind of racism that you were dealing with at Swarthmore compared to what you would experience in Tallahassee?
Growing up in the South, we always knew there were racial issues because in Jim Crow, there were signs that said white only. Then we were colored, so colored only. Schools were segregated by race. Everything was segregated by race. And we lived in the protective, my family lived in the protective cocoon of Florida A&M University. Up north, the racism that we experienced was different. It wasn't in your face, I hate you racism. It's what you would call today microaggressions that are sometimes indirect slights at a difference in status. For example, we learned maybe a year or so after we had arrived at Swarthmore that white students were given a questionnaire and they were asked whether they would accept a black roommate. Black students were not told of this questionnaire. We were never given an opportunity to select a roommate on the basis of race. But more than that, we were shocked, I was shocked, that race was a factor in sorting out who would be my roommate. And that difference in treatment showed me or told me, was a message to me, that the college cared more about the white students' concern about race than the black students' concern about race.
There was an organization put together while you were there, the Swarthmore Afro-American Student Society. How did you say that, by the way? Is it SASS or SASS?
SASS, and it's not, it should, we should know that the acronym is SASS, and we believe that we were somewhat sassy in some of our things.
How did that come together?
It grew organically. We were friends as black students. Many of us had white friends and black friends, but there was a common coming together of black students around social activities, politics, just chit-chatting, where you're going to get your hair done, for the guys, where they're going to get their hair cut. And it started out as a friendship, a home away from home. And as we evolved and needed funding for social and cultural activities, we learned that if we were an official organization, we could apply for funding. And in 1967 or 68, I believe it was 67, we petitioned the student council for formal recognition as an organization and received funding to support what was then called Negro History Week programs. But that was the only time we called it Negro History Week. After that, it was called Black History.
I'm speaking with Marilyn Hollyfield. She's a co-author of the new book, Seven Sisters and a Brother, about the 1969 8-day sit-in at Swarthmore College. You could read more about the book by going to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Let's talk about this sit-in, 8-day sit-in, again, at the college, got national attention. Were there points in which the administration seemed to acquiesce to your demands, or were they constantly in just a battle with you?
It wasn't a battle. It's not a Quaker style to battle. Mm. It's a style of polite indifference. And it was that polite indifference that created a sense in us that they did not hear our voice. Their ears were deaf to our concerns. A tipping point was when the Dean of Admissions issued a report detailing demographics about the tiny population of Black students. At that time, the four classes of students at Swarthmore, freshman through senior year, comprised about 47 students. And the Dean of Admissions issued a report that detailed our family income, our grades, our
private information. They were just giving it out.
Today, release of that information to the public would be illegal. They put this information in a report in the General Reserve Library. We, through SAS, asked the dean to remove the report from the General Library Reserve. And repeatedly, the dean refused to remove the report. Without an explanation of what the purpose of the report was, we could only see that the report released private information about not only ourselves, but our families, whether we were in single-parent homes or two-parent homes, to our peers, other college students, and our white professors. The refusal of the administration to remove this private information from the public domain of the college was a tipping point and demonstrated to us that they could not see us. They could not see our humanity. They could not hear our voices. They could not comprehend the importance that we believed in our quest for Black studies, in our quest for Black professors, and in our quest for more Black students. At that time, the number of Blacks in the incoming freshman class had decreased to around 50%. That also showed us that the college was not listening. The college did not consider our issues important. So again, it was a polite indifference.
And on the eighth day, tragedy strikes. The college president, Courtney Smith, dies of a heart attack. Is it true that some people were blaming you guys for that?
For decades afterwards, it seemed as if, well, at the time, they blamed us. They called us murderers. They never really...
For just sitting in?
For sitting in a peaceful protest. And the president, those who knew his family knew that he had a long-standing heart condition, and he had intended to retire. And we were, if you were to take a look at us, we were the most nonviolent persons that you could imagine. And you'll see at one point in the book, someone says, it wouldn't have taken more than a brush of wind to disengage the doors or the locks on the doors. But it was cruel. It was, again, a lack of recognition of our humanity for people to accuse vulnerable teenagers who were engaged in polite, nonviolent protests.
And something important about this book is that it's about trying to clarify the history, because a lot of the history was centered on this death and then everything else. But this book is your stories bringing to light what really happened, everything that happened, not just around that.
And the reporting in the New York Times and the Washington Post at that time said that we were led by outside agitators, that our motives were to not the motives that we had, but they created motives that were figments of their imagination. We think it's important to correct that history, but we also think it's important because the history of the coming of Black studies to college campuses is nearly forgotten. Few people walking on college campuses actually know that Black studies came as a result of Black student protests around the country. And in the words of Professor Henry Louis Gates of Harvard, it was Black students who risk their futures, and in our case, indeed our lives, to make a difference.
When you look back on those moments, you look back on the Sidon especially, what does that mean to you? I mean, it's history, and it's an important historical moment in when you put all civil rights battles together, it's such an important part of that. But what do you think about that history and everything that happened? You were part of it.
When you're engaged in something that might later be considered history, you're not thinking of it from a historical perspective. You're a teenager. You feel you have these goals that are right and just. You feel a sense of urgency. You feel a sense of, if not now, when? And so much would be lost. I believe it's only in hindsight that it really hit us that it was important history. When some of us returned to the college for our 40th anniversary, Black students in particular were curious about, well, how did SAS form? What were the Seven Sisters all about anyway? How is it that we have Black studies? Their response was so inspiring that it ignited our sense that, well, maybe this is important history.
And talking about history, because I cannot let you go without asking, you are now working in Miami to preserve the history of the African diaspora in South Florida in a museum. Tell me about that.
I'm working with a group of valiant, committed working group members to create a museum dedicated to contemporary art of the African diaspora. So often the creative genius of African people is lost in all of the mix of things. We want to create a global platform to showcase, to discover, to collect art of the global African diaspora, which would include artists from Europe, of African descent, North and South America, the Caribbean, and Africa as the motherland. We would, of course, embrace artists from the continent.
And where are we right now in this project?
We are in the midst of, well, along this journey, we've had community meetings. We've had support from Miami-Dade County. We've had support from the Knight Foundation. We have had support from the community. And we've been able to fund a high-quality feasibility study. We hosted a wonderful, successful pop-up exhibit last summer. We co-sponsored an art exhibit at the Low Art Museum of Juan Roberto Diago, an Afro-Cuban artist. We are in the midst of an opportunity assessment gap analysis that is being conducted by museum consultants La Placa Cohen. The Knight Foundation in Miami-Dade County provided funds for these consultants to do a study that would help us define exactly where we can make the most benefit and leverage knowing what our strengths are and understanding what our weaknesses are.
I have to have you back so we can talk more about this.
Thank you very much.
I really appreciate it.
I would love to talk more about it.
Marilyn Hollifield, again, co-author of the new book, Seven Sisters and a Brother, about the 1969 8-day sit-in at Swarthmore College. You can read more about the book and the history. Find us on social media at WLRN Sundial. Marilyn, thanks again.
And thank you so much for having me.
Well, still to come, can South Florida roads be safe for cyclists and cars? That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. It's likely that a majority of you listening to today's program took your car to work, not a bike. It could be that you have a long commute, or maybe it's the heat, or you just might be scared of riding a bike in South Florida. Florida consistently ranks as one of the most dangerous states in the country for cyclists. Last August, Chef Flavia Carnicelli was killed on her morning commute to work on Miami Beach. This week, activists in Miami took action calling for protected bike lanes on the Venetian Causeway. Are bike lanes enough to keep cyclists safe across South Florida? Whose responsibility is this? Is it bikers, cyclists, drivers, lawmakers? Joining me now in studio for this panel conversation are Eli Stiers, a Miami-based personal injury lawyer who handles a lot of cyclist cases. Eli, great to have you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining me is Andrea Iglesias with Urban Health Partnerships. Andrea, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Roger McVeigh is an avid cyclist who worked on the City of Key West bike and pedestrian plan. Roger, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Eli, I want to start with you. First of all, you bike a lot.
I do.
All right. I mean, tell me a little bit. Today, did you bike, by the way, to the show?
I actually use the Metro Mover.
You use the Metro Mover. That's all right. But for you, I mean, I wanted to get a sense of, can you point to one thing that explains why Florida and South Florida specifically seems like such a dangerous place for cyclists?
Well, you know, there's a lot of factors. I think the most important factor in terms of explaining why our roads are so dangerous is because Florida and our streets were built at a time when the car was paramount, and that was the only means of real viable transportation. You know, our roads, the foundation on which our cities and our streets were planned, was based on 1950s, 1960s auto-centric thinking, right? So we were thinking, we're going to be driving cars to and from the suburbs, to our jobs in the cities, in perpetuity, and it's never going to stop, and we're just going to keep growing that way.
Infrastructure.
That's right.
Is what you're saying mostly. You know what, Roger? I mean, because you live in Key West, and I mean, I've been down there a few times. Very different, right? I mean, better for cyclists, safer?
It is. It is different, and I would say yes on safer, because Key West was one of the cities built in the late 1800s, early 1900s, that was literally built for pedestrians and for carriages and for things before the automobile. And as a result, many, if not all of our city streets are very narrow in width, and which is conducive from the standpoint of slowing cars down. It's a design impact in roads that tends to cause speeding cars to slow down somewhat. But all that being said, the automobile certainly in future years has taken over Key West. And notwithstanding that we have one of the highest commute ratios in the country, I think, of people actually bicycling to their jobs in Key West because of the geography of being such a small kind of 7-square-mile island.
Eli, the other thing, too, is, I mean, you represent people who end up in these accidents. It makes me think, I mean, I hear the stories from time to time, the very tragic ones, where someone is killed. But it also makes me wonder, are there a lot of accidents that there's a need for someone like you?
There are a lot of accidents. Yes, I you know, speaking for obvious reasons, I'm a bit biased, but yes, I think there is a need for someone like me. but there's more than anything, there's a need for advocates in general in Miami-Dade County, in Miami in particular, who are speaking for those who don't want to drive. We drive almost out of necessity here in South Florida. There's many people, such as my colleague across from me here, who would love to bike to work. Would love to bike to and from events and activities, but don't feel safe doing so. I do so. That's my personal choice. You know, I'm an avid cyclist. I love to do it, but there's a lot of people. There's a barrier to entry, and that's what we're trying to address here locally.
Andre, your nonprofit partners with local organizations and communities to try to make them safer. Let me start with this. You know, I'm lumping all of South Florida together. Mm-hmm. It's not a safe place. Florida in general, not a safe place, but are there neighborhoods you can point to and say, well, no, this one's doing something really, really good, and this one's kind of safe?
You know what? I think there's a lot of improvements that are being made throughout South Florida, and you can see the investment being made in different communities. I know that even, for example, in Little Havana, there's not a lot of infrastructure. There's a lot of need, but there's a lot of attention being paid to that area, and leadership that's saying, okay, we need to do something different here. The city of West Palm Beach just won an award at the Safe Streets Summit for best community because of all the work that they're doing there for a long time around improving bicycle infrastructure and as well for pedestrians. So just some examples.
For you, what is it you're trying to do? What is it you want to do? your goal.
Yeah, absolutely. So our nonprofit is focused on mobilizing community and decision makers to improve the conditions that help people be healthier and to make healthier choices. And having access to transportation, including safe bicycle infrastructure and options, is a very important part of that. We want people at a minimum to be safe, right? It's about saving lives. But that's really just the minimum. We want people who rely on biking and walking to be able to access their daily needs.
But you don't feel safe riding a bike.
I don't. Okay. I don't myself. But we want to for people to feel safe and to be able to have access to whatever transportation mode they need and want to meet those daily needs.
You know, we've asked people to tell us whether streets are for people not in cars. Dozens of you responded. Let's hear from Paul in Palmetto Bay.
My name is Paul Schwepp. I live in Palmetto Bay, and I ride from my home to my office in Coconut Grove. And I have found over the years, going up and down Old Cutler Road, and I know some people would want to dispute this in South Florida, but by and large, our drivers are very considerate of bicyclists. People give me room. Nobody driving a car wants to hit someone on a bicycle.
My name is Kirk Kaminer, and I live in an unincorporated area of Miami-Dade County near Coral Gables. Our streets are not safe for anyone. Not anyone on foot, on a bike, or yes, even people in their automobiles. For anybody who has tried to bicycle commute in Miami, they of course have experienced how bicycle infrastructure is treated as a complete afterthought, if thought of at all.
Roger, what do you think about those two opinions? I heard two different things there.
I think that you'll get a, if you're an avid cyclist and you're not afraid to ride on the roads with the cars today, which I would count me in that category along with Eli, I guess, you'll find all sorts out there. But I don't disagree that a majority of the drivers try to do the right thing and are generally respectful and courteous. But there is a good portion of drivers that don't understand the rules and the laws and don't understand that bicycles have as much right to the roads in the state as cars do, as when there's not a bike lane present, and that they're required to wait and slow and provide 3 feet when it's safe to pass. And some of it's an education that needs both. There's bicycle users that don't follow the rules of the road that should, and then there's lots of cars that are just ignorant of the laws and the rules of the road.
Eli, you're a cyclist. What did you think about the comments you just heard? I mean, what Paul tells us, no, drivers are nice.
I know Paul and Kurt well. It's funny to hear two sides of the same coin. I think they're maybe speaking past each other a little bit, because both can be true. Cyclists are out on the roads daily. There's thousands of people who ride, not just for recreation, but also for transportation in Miami. And yes, by and large, drivers are courteous. There's not this epidemic of people being hit on the streets in Miami, in Miami-Dade County. Yes, I do represent people who are injured in accidents. It does happen more than you'd like to see. But there's so many more people out there enjoying their lives, getting healthy, enjoying Miami's weather, and getting to and from work, and sometimes in a faster fashion than they could in a car.
In your experience, yeah, what do you tend to see more often? Who's to blame?
Oh, without question, it's the drivers.
It's the drivers.
Question. Absolutely, absolutely. You've got to realize that, you know, drivers in a 2,000-pound metal box, oftentimes texting, oftentimes not aware of their surroundings, and you have cyclists who are doing everything they're supposed to be doing under the law, which is, you know, riding either rightmost position in the lane, unprotected from the elements, unprotected by that metal exoskeleton. So they're at a power disadvantage.
Right.
And generally, you know, it's the drivers who need to be a little bit more aware of the cyclists, scooter riders, pedestrians, et cetera, who are out of the road, sharing the road with them.
Roger was telling us about infrastructure, and I wanted to get a sense from you as a cyclist. What neighborhoods in South Florida would you just never go into because you don't feel like, no, this is just not safe, but others that might be safe? Which ones are doing it right?
Well, you know,
have made changes that you like?
Without question, Miami Beach is leading the way in terms of progressive, novel for Florida cycling infrastructure, not just in terms of planning, but also in terms of doing. There's a lot of planning being done at the county and at the city of Miami level, but it's not necessarily being implemented as fast as we'd like. Miami Beach is leading the way in that regard. Fort Lauderdale, West Palm Beach are doing some great things as well. But yeah, of course, there's parts of Miami you don't want to drive in. Those are the same areas you don't want to ride a bike in either.
Andrea, what kind of solutions do you hear from people? I imagine people come to you and tell you, what if we did this or this or this or this? What are you hearing?
Well, we hear a lot because a lot of what we do is ensuring that community members have a voice in this process and that they tell decision makers what they want to see and what they need in their communities. And a lot of what we hear is, I don't even have a way to get to the park. There's not a sidewalk. There's not a bike lane. I'm afraid to, walk to and from school with my kids. So this is an issue that they're facing on an everyday basis, and they would like to see some action. I think what you might hear from a lot of community members is a lot of frustration, right? So maybe there's some acknowledgement of the problem, but then they see no action. And the truth is that a lot of the plans that are made take 30, 40, 50 years to implement. And understandably, the community starts to mistrust the process.
We always have this conversation with city and county leaders about growth and how fast this area is growing. Do you get the sense, though, that there is that cooperation, that they get that part of it, that leaders get that part of what you're talking about in trying to provide more of these opportunities?
I think some do, but I think everyone has to do more and has to show action and investment in all communities. I think a lot of times where you see that growth and investment is in the places where there's already a lot of resources. And then we have these communities that are disenfranchised, where there's been disinvestment and not getting any of the attention. And the worst part is when they do get attention, it can lead to displacement if not done in a way that's thoughtful and with the community rather than to them.
Again, we're focused on the issue of bike safety in South Florida. Joining me in studio for this panel conversation are Eli Stiers, City of Miami attorney, Andrea Iglesias with Urban Health Partnership, and Roger McVeigh, a cyclist who worked on the city's Key West cycling plan. And again, we've been asking people if they feel safe riding their bikes in South Florida. We heard from some of you.
Hello, my name is Sabine, and I am from Miami, Florida. I do not believe that our streets are safe for people who are not in cars. While riding, I came face to face with a car that was using the M-Path to avoid standing in traffic on US-1. I was in complete disbelief because really that's the last place that I expected to see a car. And honestly, I was too frustrated and in shock to even remember to take a picture. And so in frustration, I let them go by. And I keep on riding, and several minutes later, I felt the presence of a vehicle behind me. And when I turn around, the same car had gotten back onto the M-Path in order to head back in the direction that they originally came from. There's just no respect for anyone on foot or bike here, and it is an issue that needs to be addressed.
Eli, let's understand some of the rules, but also rights. Let's say if I'm in a designated bike lane, a car swerves over into my lane, I'm knocked over. What's the course of action?
Well, you know,
besides obviously, you know, getting hospital, going to the hospital,
getting
if I need
medical. First thing you need to do is obviously call the authorities, get a police report, get medical attention. You know, if you have the wherewithal to do it, you know, consider bringing a legal claim. Contacting an attorney like myself. But, you know, to answer the original question, you know, people need to understand that bikes are vehicles. We have the same rights to be on the roadway as a car. You know, a bike is a unique vehicle in that we can take our vehicles off the roadway onto sidewalks, onto dirt paths, et cetera. But, you know, we have to obey the same rules of the roadway. But, you know, it's a two-way street. Cars also have to give us respect as well.
Sometimes, look, in car accidents, more often than not, in the positions of the cars, you could tell who was at fault. Is it as clear-cut when you have an accident with a motor vehicle and a bicyclist?
It's never that clear-cut because you generally have, again, a vehicle driver who thinks that they're not at fault. And then you have an investigating officer, many of whom don't cycle, never been on a bike or not been on a bike in many years and don't understand the laws and how they are interpreted for cyclists. So, there's always a certain element of piecing things back together after the fact. But again, generally, you have to take into account the power dynamics and the rights of cyclists to be on the roadways. Cyclists are 9 times out of 10 doing nothing wrong.
You know, Roger, again, very different situation in Key West. We hear, though, I mean, look, you got a lot of tourists. A lot of people on bikes, but a lot of tourists. And, you know, we've also heard about the fact that people, you know, may enjoy quite a bit of libation in Key West, and they're riding their bikes probably when they shouldn't be. But I mean, you know, what have you seen with what the real issues in Key West are when you talk about bike safety?
Well, you know, I think the tourists, you know, certainly adds a wild card to the equation, because it's incumbent upon the bike shops where they rent the bikes to go through the rules of the road and make sure they understand that, you know, the children under 16, I think, are required to wear a helmet. If you're going to be riding your bike at night, you've got to use lights and always wear very visible clothing. You've got to obey the rules of the road, those kind of things. I will put in a plug for our local political leadership. You know, our city commission approved this bike and pedestrian master plan unanimously last spring of 2019. And already during the current fiscal year ending in September of 20, we've got a couple major projects from the Bike Master Plan that are being implemented to the tune of over $1 million in the city budget, which is not a small number for the city of Key West's budget. So we are making progress. The leadership sees how important it is. But then again, the bicyclists on the road that do not follow the rules, that ride at night without lights, that ride the wrong way on one-way streets and blow through stop signs and street lights, certainly aren't helping our cause as cyclists. Yeah. To encourage cars to do the right thing.
We heard from a City of Miami police officer, Dan Kerr. He patrols the Wynwood neighborhood on a bike, and he's had some experiences. Let's take a listen.
A year ago, I got rear-ended by a DUI pretty badly while working in uniform, surrounded by cops. And the attitude of the entire system. So I went through as a victim as opposed to a police officer. There was no respect for the fact that, you know, a car hit a bicyclist, much less a police officer. But just the fact that it hit a bicyclist, there was no communication with the state attorney's office. There was no sympathy from the judges. The guy got no time, and it was his second DUI.
Andrea, is it on the city, is it on government to fix this problem, or more organizations like you that have to come in? And, you know, one of the other ones, too, we talked to, are the creators of The Underline. That's this new project coming in to create more opportunities for pedestrians and cyclists. But who's this really on more? Do we just need more people like you?
Well, yes, of course. I think it's you know, an issue that affects everyone and that needs everyone to be able for us to be able to make progress. So Urban Health Partnerships often acts as a bridge between the community, between local stakeholders, government and decision makers, because everyone has to be on the same page, not only to be able to create safer and healthier designs, but also ensure that they're representative and responsive of the needs of that particular community. So everyone has to be on board.
We got a call from a Ricardo Campbell from West Palm Beach, called us and said that he thinks that bike lanes are better on the side of the road, but what proves to be better instead of in the middle? But you know, what proves to be better? Eli, what do you think of that?
Well, I assume what he's referring to is, you know, some sort of separation between the lanes of car travel and a bike lane. So there's a lot of bike lanes in Miami and Miami-Dade County, but there's no physical barrier between the car lanes and the bike lanes. So a lot of people still don't feel safe even riding in the bike lane. So what you've seen here locally is this movement, and really nationally as well, that pain is not protection. People want to see an actual physical barrier between moving car traffic and bike. So I assume what he's referring to is, can we get the bike lanes actually off the road and separate it out even more so that it's a separated path? And certainly, those are fantastic ways to get around. You see those certainly in Europe and Amsterdam, and you see actual cycle tracks and actual bike highways and freeways where people move around freely on bike on separated paths. You don't see a lot of that in the U.S. Some cities are moving in that direction. Miami-Dade County is way behind that. We just love to see more bike lanes here.
Roger, again, Key West is very different, but is there something we can learn from Key West and how things are done there?
Our bike lanes, unfortunately, do not have the separation that Eli was referring to. And more importantly, in many cases, parking is such a premium in our community that in order to get a bike lane with separation from the cars, we'd have to remove street parking from the streets, which always brings the public in an uproar. So many of the bike lanes in Key West, although safer in many cases than riding on some of the main roads, are generally door lanes, which means there's street parking along the right side of the bike lane, where at any point in time a car can open their door into the bike line, and which can be incredibly dangerous for cyclists if you're not paying real close attention to who's in their cars along the bike lane.
Andrea, if I said to you, here's a magic amount of money, let's fix something, what's one thing you want to see done right now?
One thing I want to see done right now, to echo what my colleagues are saying, is to really prioritize having not just separated bike lanes, but protected bike lanes, and make sure that people in all communities, not just the wealthy ones, have access to that.
Eli, the same question to you, but also because you said Miami's so far behind, what could we do to bring Miami, bring South Florida a little bit further advanced on this?
Well, I'm going to allude to your earlier point. Is it government, is it leadership, or is it advocacy? And it's really both. And there needs to be more and better advocacy, but there also needs to be better leadership. There needs to be this political will to implement change in South Florida. It can happen very quickly. You saw this happen in New York City just in the past 10 years. Hundreds of bike lanes and protected bike lanes have been built in New York City. In Paris, the new mayor of Paris, Anne Hidalgo, just in the past couple of years has put in hundreds of miles of protected bike paths in Paris. You've seen a 54% increase in cycling in Paris. It can be done there, but it's a two-sided component. There needs to be the push from advocates such as myself and Andrea, but you've got to see the responsiveness from the city as well.
Again, we've been talking with Eli Stiers, City of Miami attorney, Andrea Iglesias with Urban Health Partnerships, and Roger McVeigh, a cyclist who worked on Key West's city cycling plan. Thank you, all of you, so much for sharing with us today.
Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Yep.
Enjoyed it.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
We also heard from Karina Mobius in Little Havana, wrote in, it's a shame that crossing the street is such a terrifying experience. Plus, the roads are so poorly designed for cyclists that they go on sidewalks and have nearly hit me on several occasions. Yeah. Let's be safe, folks. Remember, everybody could share the road. Remember the rules. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Again, find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you on Monday.